Quintero was, at that point, marijuana was still kind of a part of this trade. The United States produces much more marijuana than Mexico now anyway, so, and much better quality. And just to give you some idea about that, in terms of the amount of marijuana that gets taken down, say a 400 kilo load gets taken down at the border, people tell me, and I've been talking to Howard Campbell, good writer from professor at UTEP, substantiating Juarez gangs, saying that the marijuana is used basically as a decoy. It pleases everybody to take down a 400 kilo load, pleases the authorities, and it pleases the drug gangs because the car right in back of that is carrying cocaine into the U.S. So, you know, this question about, oh, we took down all this marijuana and we burnt up all this marijuana is really a decoy for the harder drugs where the money is. Marijuana is bulky, it's possible to move, you have to have large trucks, and it doesn't get you any money. I mean, it's a cheap drug, you know, so it doesn't have much to do with anything except that it's used to placate both sides in the drug war. But Caro Quintero, back in the day, Caro Quintero was a major marijuana dealer. It was just as marijuana cultivation in the U.S. was beginning to take root in California. Caro Quintero was growing, we don't know exactly, the story was so inflated we don't know exactly how much, but he had supposedly 10,000 people working on this plantation in Buffalo, Chihuahua, very close to the U.S. border. De La Madrid's security forces couldn't seem to find it. The Secretary of Defense had no knowledge that this was actually taking place. You have to have a huge spread to spend, you know, to put 10,000 workers, planting and picking marijuana, but they couldn't see it. And then a contract pilot with the DEA flew over, saw it, told his boss, a DEA agent by the name of Kiki Camarena, and the rest is history. Camarena was picked up, and the pilot, Alberto Contreras, I can't remember his name, were picked up on the street in Guadalajara, taken to a mansion, tortured in the mansion. Their bodies were thrown and were buried in shallow graves on a pig farm in Michoacán. Caro Quintero tried to flee the country. He had in his possession his placa, his badge, from the Direction of Federal Security, the DFS, in his hand, signed off by the head of the DFS. And they let him go. He was finally extradited from Costa Rica, came back to the to Mexico, put on trial, imprisoned in the southern penitentiary in Mexico City, where he ran a discotheque for a while. That kind of went away, and then last heard of, he's just been transferred to the Tres Marias, which has now become like an environmental prison, you know, out in the Pacific, you know. But he's still in jail. But what happened as a result of the murder of Kiki Camarena was that the U.S. virtually went to war, was going to war. John Gavin, the ambassador at that time, was talking about U.S. troops invading Mexico, which is not politically correct in Mexico, to say the least, you know. And De La Madrid had to give up his favorite drug lord, Caro Quintero, and some of his confederates, including Ernesto Fonseca or Don Neto, under pressure of war being declared. It's interesting that one of the legends, and I tracked this down, Caro Quintero never actually said that he would pay Mexico's foreign debt, which at that point was $102 billion. No, it was actually a comedian that was impersonating him. But everybody believed it. You know, that was the important thing, is that everybody believed that Caro Quintero was going to pay Mexico's foreign debt. No. But Caro Quintero's Sinaloa boy, and the Sinaloa boys continued to be favored. Along came Carlos Salinas, who won the presidency in 1988 in an absolutely fraudulent election, which I've talked about forever. And I had the privilege of accompanying Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas for 3 years, from 87 to 89, during all of that. And, you know, we could talk about who won that election. No. And Salinas needed the U.S. backing in order to legitimize his presidency, much as we'll see how this came on later with Felipe Calderón, to legitimize his presidency and began to negotiate with the first George Bush on the North American Free Trade Agreement. Bush wanted two concessions from Mexico at that point. One was to stop the migration of Central American workers through Mexico. You remember Harlingen, Texas, 48 hours from whatever it was, or 96 hours or whatever it was. And indeed that happened. Mexico now deports 250,000 Central American workers each year. And that was, you know, one of the concessions that was asked for. The other was the head of, bring me the head of Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo, who was the guy that established the contacts with the Colombian cartels. You know? And so Felix Gallardo, a Sinaloa boy, went down, and power shifted. The drug war or the drug trade shifted both north and east. East, it went to what is now called the Gulf Cartel, under the direction of Juan Garcia Abrego. And Abrego was actually, he was one, probably the most legitimate of these guys. He came from a family of contrabandistas that had been smuggling alcohol through over the border during Prohibition. His uncle, Juan Nepocinio Garcia, was legendary. They write corridos about him. So he was a real live smuggler. You know? The Gulf Cartel had one of its bases was in Nueva León. The Salinas family is from Nueva León, very connected, and indeed there was abundant testimony of Carlos's black sheep brother. I don't know how a black sheep can have a black sheep brother, but his black sheep brother, Raul, attending parties and fiestas and private horse races with Juan Garcia and Juan Garcia Abrego. No? And so the trade went east. Planes were landing, small planes were landing all the time on Navy airstrips in Tamaulipas, right, you know, butt up against Nuevo León. And it also went north to Tijuana, where the Sinaloa boys, the Arellano Felixes, who were indeed the nephews of Miguel Angel Garcia, Felix Gallardo, had established the Tijuana cartel, and they became consentidos. Just one story to illustrate that, as many of you may remember, the Felix Arellano cartel, the Tijuana boys, got into a gunfight at the Guadalajara airport with El Chapo Guzman. We'll hear more about that in a bit. Another Sinaloa boy, and the Cardinal of Guadalajara was caught in the middle of this crossfire. Or there's another backstory, but we won't have to go into that at this point. No, you know, but I think we can trace some drug war connections here. You know, at least he got killed. That created a difficult situation. And lo and behold, months after that, with the there were 11 Arellano brothers and sisters, with the Arellano Felix clan being the most wanted people in Mexico, who shows up at the Papal Nuncio's office in Mexico City in the Colonia Guadalupe Inn, but the Arellano Felixes with a package for the Pope. We've never found out what was inside that package. And the Papal Nuncio, Prigionicus, on the phone and calls up Salinas that I got the most wanted people in the country here in my office. And Salinas doesn't even react, you know. It's like, and then they're granted safe passage back to Sinaloa. No, just an indication of what their juice was with the administration. Those are in the waning days of the Salinas administration. It's, you know, in the fall of 1993 when that happened. So, again, we have, you know, favored consentidos amongst the drug lords. Along comes Cedillo's successor, Ernesto Cedillo. Ernesto Cedillo is forced to go to Congress every March for certification from the U.S. Congress that Mexico is participating in the drug war. Each year he'll deliver up a capo to the U.S. and that kind of mitigates the situation. Congress passes, says Mexico is cooperating fully in the drug war. And he gives up Juan Garcia Abrego, no, on the premise that he was a U.S. citizen, which was not true. You know, he said he could be thrown out of the country under Article 33 of the Constitution because he was a U.S. citizen. That proved to be false. But anyway, he breaks the Gulf Cartel's leadership at that time. It would resurge later on, and the trade still stays in Tijuana, but also goes to Juarez. And the Juarez cartel under Amado Carrillo, the Lord of the Skies, the Señor de los Cielos, who kind of revolutionized the Mexican drug trade by gutting DC-6 planes and loading them up with cocaine and flying them straight into the north of the country rather than going through various other routes to get the cocaine there, and large amounts of cocaine, kind of revolutionized the drug trade. And, of course, again, who is the consentido here? Well, I only offer you General Jesus Gutierrez Rebollo, the head of the Mexican drug war, who is arrested, finally, for providing protection to Amado Carrillo, the Lord of the Skies. He's, in fact, arrested in 1997, 2 weeks after he was right here in Washington, at the White House, as a matter of fact, you know, being praised for his cooperation in the drug trade. And he has been the protector of Amado Carrillo. Amado Carrillo stepped on a lot of bad toes by changing the way drug transportation was set up. And he dies in a hospital that he had rented out a mile from Los Pinos, the Mexican White House. The lawyer for that hospital or hotel, I want to say, is Diego Fernandez de Ceballos, who was the kind of gray eminence of the National Action Party, and he dies supposedly while undergoing a liposuction procedure. The doctors that applied this procedure are then found cut into little pieces in barrels of cement along the highway to Acapulco. Goodbye, Amado Carrillo. Okay. And that all takes place in the waning days of the Cedillo administration. Of course, in 2000, things changed, right? The PRI finally lost power after 7 decades of vilification and discredit. And the National Action Party, the PAN, the right-wing party, takes over. Vicente Fox is inaugurated in December of 2000, and in January of 2001, El Chapo Guzman walks out of a prison in Jalisco, in Puente Grande, walks out of prison in a laundry car and disappears, and we've never heard from him, or he's never been touched since. For the last 10 years, El Chapo Guzman has been the narco consentido of the decade, no, and of the administration. And it now appears that El Chapo Guzman has been eminently available for a long period of time. And I only give you the interview that Julio Scherer was able to obtain just a couple of weeks ago, well, actually months ago, but was just published a couple of weeks ago, with El Mayo Zambada, who is Chapo Guzman's lead associate. And in that interview, El Mayo says, you know, do you want to interview El Chapo Guzman? I think we can set up an interview. So if Julio Sierra, who is probably Mexico's preeminent journalist, the founder of Proceso, but an old man. And if Julio Sierra can get to El Mayo Zambada, if he can get to Chapo Guzman, you can be sure that the government can get to him. And I think that interview is a must to read. You know, it doesn't reveal a whole lot, but it's a must to read just in terms of approaching the so-called drug lords and how they, what their lifestyle is these days. Because apparently that interview, it wasn't very high. No, so let's come up to the present, up to 2006. Felipe Calderón is awarded a stolen election over Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Half the country does not believe that he's the legitimate president of Mexico. He's inaugurated on December 1st, 2006. The military has to escort him to the microphone in the Congress because the templete, the platform in Congress, is occupied by the PRD, by members of the Left Center Party, who believe that AMLO has won the election. And 6 days after the military has escorted him to the microphone, he gets on the national horn and says he's sending 30,000 troops into Michoacán, his home state, to deal with the drug cartels. Why? He had no authority. The military granted him authority in this situation, granted him legitimacy, or at least an attempt to obtain legitimacy by the use of the military. And what has happened since then is, you know, you can't really do these things because of political pragmatism, and that's a nice word, nice way of saying what Calderon did here. No, but since that date, December 6th, 2006, 23,000 people are dead. Well, almost 20. The numbers change every day. The Post is saying nearly 23,000 here. 2,700 dead in Juarez last year. Clock it out to see how much, how many get killed every hour. And the battle for Juarez, basically, we've been reading stories that say El Chapo has won that battle against the remnants of the Juarez cartel, against Amado Carrillo, and now controls that city. Now, a guy I've been following is a guy named Edgardo Buscalia at the ITEM in Mexico City, the Institute Technological of the State of Mexico, rather, who has analyzed 50,000 arrests made since December 6th, 2006, and considers that only 2,000 low-level members of Chapo Guzman's cartel have been arrested. No majors have gone down in this, no. And probably the most egregious incident of how selective enforcement is was the takeout of the Beltran Levas in Cuernavaca in last December. The Beltran Levas had been associates of El Chapo. They split with him and formed their own cartel, the South Pacific Cartel, and they were taken out in a gunfight in a very posh section of Cuernavaca that overlooks the 24th Military Region. No, they're kind of condominiums, you know, high-rise condominiums. Overlooks the 24th Military Region. The people that went after, that took down the Beltran Levas were the Navy, were the Marines, not the Army. What this tells us is that the Army can't be trusted any longer. We've known that for a long time. The Army was brought in basically because the police couldn't be trusted. So now we're looking at the Navy as being the lead force on drug enforcement in Mexico, and it's only a matter of time before that gets corrupted, no? Buscalia says that negotiations with El Chapo are already underway, and he anticipates that by 2012, the next presidential election, we will see a diminishment of the drug war in Mexico because of this connection between El Chapo and Calderon, no? 1996, Caspar Weinberger wrote an interesting book called The Next War. It had scenarios about where the next war would be fought. And Caspar Weinberger, of course, Ronald Reagan's defense secretary, Star Wars, all of Caspar Weinberger's baggage that we know about. And one of the scenarios was for a U.S. invasion of Mexico in 2006 because the country had been taken over by the drug cartels and that the president was in the service of the drug cartels. No, so I want you to keep that scenario in mind because it does bear relevance to the situation that we're looking at. No. Washington wants enhanced influence over Mexico's security forces. There's three areas in which they have moved ahead on this. One is the creation of the NORCOM, the North Command in Colorado, which now which makes Mexico into its southern security perimeter, you know, and allows for U.S. overflights of Mexican territory and eventually, if necessary, the landing of U.S. troops to defeat all security threats to the U.S. in Mexico. That's under the NORCOM. The other factor that we hear a lot about here, but not much in Mexico, is what we call ASPAN. And I always the security and what?
Prosperity partnership.
Prosperity, yeah, right, okay. Security and prosperity lies. Prosperity. You know, this country is now like, is now in the midst, the depths of a depression, you know, with probably 40% unemployment at this point. The only light at the end of the tunnel was the drug trade. We have 500,000 people working in the drug trade at this point. You know, so anyway, that's the prosperity we're talking about here. But ASPAN seeks to integrate the security forces of the three NAFTA countries. It's kind of a NAFTA for security forces, Canada, Washington, and the United States. So the idea is to bring the Mexican security forces on board. We don't hear much about ASPAN these days. It's been kind of downgraded in the Obama administration. And then finally, of course, the Merida Initiative, which is all about increased cooperation between Mexican security forces and U.S. security forces. And as a result, we have DEA and FBI offices in every provincial city. We had just had a drug lord taken down in Baja California Sur de Tejo by ICE. I mean, did we know that ICE was working in the country and dealing in the drug war? Located by, you know, immigration, customs enforcement. Probably threw someone across the border and had his address in his pocket or on his cell phone or something like that, you know. But we have U.S. security agencies working all over Mexico, spread out throughout the... From Tuxtla Gutierrez, somebody drove me past the FBI, DEA offices there recently, you know. So, you know, that's where they are in there. So they're everywhere, and they have been there, actually, for a while. And the question is, are the agents armed? You know, of course, they're armed. The U.S. refuses to say whether the agents are armed. I bring this up because it would be politically incorrect for the U.S. to land forces in Mexico. The U.S. has invaded Mexico on countless occasions. Scenarios in the War College talk about U.S. invasions from the north. It just wouldn't work to put U.S. groups on the ground. But we have all these civil agencies, FBI and DEA and CIA and all the initial agencies that you want to, you know, ATF, all of them working in Mexico. CIA is satellite overflights all the time. NORCOM planes flying over Mexico. Coast Guard has taken over Mexico's coastlines. And I anticipate that in the near future we're going to see, if they're not there already and we just haven't located them, contractors, proxies, Blackwater, now called whatever it's called, and other contractors. Blackwater is certainly not the only contractor, security contractor, so there's many other agencies. I expect we'll see them or find them in the near future. The specter, here it is, of the drug war spillover, you know, every day in our newspapers, five columns here in the Washington Post, kind of doesn't take into account that El Paso is one of the five safest cities in the United States and is actually booming as a result of the drug war. Real estate has gone up because people are moving out of Juarez, businesses are moving from Juarez, restaurants are moving from Juarez, and, you know, the El Paso has suddenly had this economic, you know, upsurge as a result of all of this. Now, but all of this, the drug war spillover, really is part of what I was talking about before, Mexico bashing, to bring pressure upon Mexico for both the security advantages and the economic advantages. And I think, as I mentioned before, that the prize is Pemex. And I mentioned that Pemex has been privatized in its various sectors, but it remains a state corporation, you know? And the real prize in terms of Pemex now is deep water drilling in the waters off of the Atlantic coast, of the Caribbean coast of Mexico at this point. And they're all poised. Exxon, everybody is poised to get in there and do it. Congress has been reluctant to allow risk contracts, which would give U.S. and transnational drillers a percentage of the oil that comes in. And that's now being fought out. It's been fought out for the last couple of years, but I think the prize, the eye that Mexico offers to Washington now is, we're out of oil in Mexico. We have 9 years left of oil, but there are deposits out there in the deep water, and Mexico doesn't have the technology to do it. And so, in order to be able to get it, you've got to contract with the big guns. And I think that's what Washington is trying to break down. That's what I think they mean by the privatization of Pemex. And that is a violation of Mexico's sovereignty, of course, but they utilize both these hot button issues, immigration and the drug war, in order to be able to exert pressure on Mexico for economic advantage. You know? So I think that's what I came to say.
This was John Ross at the Institute for Policy Studies on April 21st, 2010, discussing how Washington gave Mexico a drug problem.